Guess what? Arizona's brought in more revenue than expected this year, and for some, that money is just burning a hole in the treasurer's pocket. How do policy advocates get their hands on it?
There's probably about 600 of them calling in. So I suspect that the so-called windfall has been committed, at least mentally, many, many times over.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Phoenix voters will decide the fate of its transportation projects. Are layoffs at the University of Phoenix a harbinger for more trouble at for-profit universities?
And could a new Valley Freeway have lanes for non-motorized vehicles?
You've really got a situation where bikers and you know, cars conflict. And to push more bikers onto normal streets just adds to the conflict.
Plus, what's the deal with all that lightning and roller skate summer camp?
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Slight chance for rain tonight around the valley, blowing dust, a possibility as well. Expect overnight lows in the upper 80s. Quick check of valley traffic. An accident 202 westbound at McClintock is blocking the shoulder. There's also an accident I-17 northbound at Anthem Way blocking the left lane.
The legislature's budget analysts report Arizona has brought in $257 million more dollars than expected so far this year. That, predictably, has led to discussions about what to do with that money. Many Democrats want to put it into programs that have been cut over the past several years, like education, while many Republicans have talked about being cautious with the cash and maybe paying down some of the state's debt. To sort out some of the options and the thought process to get there, we turn to Alan McGuire, an economist and president of the Phoenix-based McGuire Company.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of constituent groups that are calling in and saying, oh, golly, you know, last year's budget process, the one that we just completed a few months ago, was really tough. And if I could just get another $5 or $7 million, it would make a big difference to my program. But there's probably about 600 of them calling in. So I suspect that the so-called windfall has been committed, at least mentally, many, many times over. So part of what you have to be careful of is the economy gives and the economy takes. And this economy has been fairly uneven. I mean, we were literally negative in the first quarter of this year nationally. Arizona's been chunking along pretty well, but a little caution is well advised at this point in time.
In your mind, is this money that should just be set aside somewhere to see what happens? Do you think any amount of it should be spent in the near future?
Well, my view is that any money you carry over from one fiscal year to the next is there when you need to spend it come the next budget session. That's the great thing about government revenues. They just go and sit in the Treasury. They don't disappear. And this isn't a huge amount. I mean, yeah, at the end of session, when they're in the throes of the budget debate, $10 million is a lot. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, we're up about 3.5% over the forecast level. That's not so bad. Frankly, as complicated as the economy has been in recent years and as complicated as revenues are, being within 3.5 to 5%, pretty good estimate, I would say. So yeah, there's a windfall, but I'm more prone to wait, do it as a part of the large budget process, and let everybody have a fair shot at it.
So when lawmakers and the governor convene their next session in January and are looking at what to do with this money, how do they prioritize, okay, we have 500 constituency advocacy groups saying we need some money, we'd love some money. How do they figure out which ones get it and which ones don't?
Right. The budget process and the budget document itself is the ultimate political exercise. It is the reflection, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, but it is the reflection of the priorities of the governing elected officials of the state of Arizona. And truthfully, much of what they spend the money on is driven by formulas and requirements.
Stuff they have to do.
Federal obligations. So the stuff at the margin is the real key. The other thing to keep in mind is there are a lot of open questions, particularly fiscal questions right now before the state. They have litigation over the K-12 system. They have the risk of access funding over time, what's going to happen with Obamacare funding and reimbursement levels and things like that. All those challenges are out there. They have a couple billion dollars worth of essentially operating debt from the last recession they haven't paid off. So I would not characterize these as good times from state government's perspective, pretty decent times for the economy, but not great times for state government. So I would be cautious before I went and spent that money. Might not hurt to pay down some debt with it.
When revenues come in above projections like this, does that put pressure on the folks who are making those projections from lawmakers who say, look, if we had known we were going to have this extra money, we could have put it in program X or into agency Y?
Oh, yeah. There's always pressure on the budget folks, and particularly the revenue forecasters. It's an incredibly complicated process. Hundreds of moving parts that you're trying to figure out. But of course, there's pressure on them. And it's pressure both ways. If you come in too high, there's huge pressure on you. If you come in too low, there's more pressure on you. So all that really maybe happens is that the people putting pressure on you change.
Alan McGuire is an economist and president of the Phoenix-based McGuire Company.
Since the Great Recession, the steady drumbeat of increasing the number of college graduates and diversifying the Arizona economy has gotten louder. More grads are supposed to equal more jobs and higher wages. But how broad would the benefits be? A new study by a couple of ASU economists, The Economic Impact of Raising the Educational Attainment of Arizona's Workforce, concludes that workers without degrees would do quite well. Dennis Hoffman is director of the Seidman Research Institute at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and a co-author of the study. So, Dennis, how would employees without college degrees benefit?
The basic logic here is that businesses become more productive. They pay these higher skilled workers more. And certainly there are individual returns to individuals that have degrees. But as the knowledge and skills of those individuals ripple through the economy, as businesses become more productive, as levels of prosperity rise in an economy, the returns, empirically at least, if you look across major metros across this nation, and economies across this nation, a lot of the wage benefits really do accrue. In fact, the majority of the wage benefits accrue to high school recipients and less than high school recipients.
So, Dennis, are we seeing now then, because even as there's job growth in Arizona, there's concern that the types of jobs are lower wage jobs, lower skilled jobs in many cases. If, in fact, the state was producing more college graduates and those college graduates were then, in fact, starting businesses or helping grow businesses, ultimately, in an ideal world, is what you're saying with the simulation and if Arizona took those steps, is that a way to buffer and make stronger the middle class, which we always hear about? The middle class has been suffering more than any other class.
Well, absolutely it is. But you also hit on something, Steve, that's really very important in this type of analysis. We have to focus not only on the production of educated people and encourage them and provide them entrepreneurial opportunities to form their own businesses or to add value to existing businesses. We also have to adopt a strategy designed to attract those businesses that are looking to hire college grads, not just attract those businesses looking to hire low-wage workers in kind of the traditional population growth serving businesses that Arizona has been known for. So it's going to require, this is a simulation that shows the big payoff to investments in higher education and in getting a higher educated workforce. The challenges are really great. You have to produce more and you have to embark upon a strategy that attracts more of these businesses here.
Since the economy has picked up a bit, since the state seems to have some extra money, should state lawmakers and the governor be spending more money right now on K-12 education?
Well, K-12 is certainly an area that the state needs to address, Steve, in my opinion. You know, we certainly have several hundred million more than the legislature at least thought we were going to have in March. And I think there's some concern about permanent expenditures. You know, frankly, I've been here 37 years. It's not my observation that we ever have any permanent expenditures in Arizona. They come and go. Not the same as can be said, frankly, for tax cuts. Tax cuts are, once they're instituted, they're here forever.
Dennis Hoffman is director of the Seidman Research Institute at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. He's the co-author of a new study called The Economic Impact of Raising the Educational Attainment of Arizona's Workforce. Dennis, thanks for talking.
Steve, it was great talking with you.
Has the Valley missed an opportunity to move from car culture to bike-friendly? Chandler City Councilman Rick Uman is aiming to modify that. He's calling for the proposed South Mountain Freeway to include a parallel activity path for bike riders and joggers and others. Uman explains why it's needed.
Pecos Road has been used for years as a great training grounds for a lot of bikers, recreational people. And it's a path that's being used for people to go around the mountain, as they say, and then come back down on baseline. And I just thought it was a great opportunity as we're building this new freeway to put a separate lane outside the freeway. Obviously, you know, you don't want people driving on the freeway, but a 10 to 15 foot path that parallels the highway. We lived in Denver back in the 80s, and when they built C-470, which wraps around from Interstate 25 to Interstate 70, they did that all the way around. It's probably 25 miles. Great amenity, used by a lot of people, a lot of hills up and down, the whole nine yards. But you've really got a situation where bikers and you know, cars conflict, and to push more bikers onto normal streets just adds to the conflict. And here's an amenity for not just for bikers, but for runners, for walkers, with moms with their strollers, whatever it might be. And, you know, we really need to be looking at multimodal kinds of transportation. So this should have been something that was a little bit more visionary on the part of, you know, the people doing it and saying, hey, you know what, this is a great amenity. Let's do this. And every freeway that's being built for the future, you know, whether it's in southeast, you know, down in Mesa, going down to Pinal County, you should figure out a way to do some kind of parallel thing.
Is this a community in general, you think, that pays enough attention to alternative means of transportation? Like, in general, as you go around the valley, do you think there are more opportunities there?
I think there's a lot more opportunities. And the Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, has been working for years to try and connect, you know, the old SRP canals that were never used are now being interconnected. Tempe did their Western Canal project. We did our Western Canal project. Gilbert's now hooking up their project. So you'll be able to go from the Arizona Mills Mall down through Tempe, through Chandler and Mesa into Gilbert, and then go down south. It's about 26 miles. And we need to be looking for those kinds of amenities. You know, the canals are a natural one, but, you know, there's no canals down where this is, you know, this freeway is going. We should have been thinking about that on the 101 going up into Scottsdale.
So, Rick, when you bring this up to MAG, or when you've thought about this idea, do people sort of look at you oddly like they never thought of it, or do they think, well, that would be a cute idea, but we really can't do it?
I'm not going to point fingers at anybody, but I think that people have to think a little bit outside the box, and it's not just about cars and trucks. It should be about a total multimodal kind of a transportation system. And, you know, as we're building light rail on a lot of places, and, you know, we have bike racks on light rail. We have buses where you can put your bikes in front. And, you know, gas prices are cheap for a while right now, but, you know, we all know that's probably not going to last forever. And people, this is a recreational kind of an area, but you also do have people that would use it probably to commute different places.
And Rick, we're talking about a standard path here, right? We're not talking about public art to go along with it. It's just sort of a nice, okay.
We're talking about a concrete path. If you go on the Western Canal, we basically have a 10-foot wide concrete path that runs parallel to the Salt River Project canals.
I've lived here most of my life, and it's always had that label of being a car culture. Do you feel like that is changing as we go along?
I think that mentality is changing. It's slowly changing, but you have a lot of younger generation that are looking for, you know, why is downtown Tempe so successful? Why is downtown Phoenix starting to grow again? People want to live closer to work, but people want to have those amenities. Let's get more people out of their cars. If they want to be, let them have that amenity to be able to do it.
Chandler City Councilman Rick Uman.
Driving around the valley over the past several days, you may have seen some tents with banners flapping in parking lots. They tend to pop up around July 4th and New Year's, the two times of year Arizonans can legally buy and use certain types of fireworks. To find out more about this, I met up with Jason Hallaby of Loco Fireworks at one of his three tents. Hallaby's day job is the owner of an auto repair shop. He says he's been running tents for as long as it's been legal as a hobby. I asked him if there's money to be made selling fireworks out of a tent.
You know, I call it vacation money. So twice a year we do this. I have my family help me out, my son, my daughter, and my wife. And when we're done with the season, you know, we count our profits and we take a vacation. That's really all we do with it. So
Is there confusion when people come in here about what they are and are not allowed to buy and where they can and can't use it?
Absolutely. We're always educating the public on where, when you can use it, and what you can and can't use. You know, it's comical. We get a lot of customers come in and say, you know, where's the big stuff? We want the firecrackers. We want the mortars. And so some people don't consider these real fireworks, you know. I'm putting my hands up in quotation there when I say that. For the most part, you know, people are, they love this. It's fun, you know. It's the same faces every year, you know, familiar faces. We get to know our customers, and we get to see them twice a year. It's fun.
So do you have to tell people as the laws change about sort of where they're allowed to do stuff and, you know, what you can and can't sell and what they can and can't buy?
Yeah, we've found that every season the laws change so far. It's like every, and when I mean season, I don't mean the year. I mean, July and December, you know, the laws change. So we're always updating them on the times they can use it, the dates they can use it, what they can, can't use. That's been a little confusing in the beginning on what kind of products they can, we can sell and they can use and what kind of product they can. But lately they've had much more clarity on it, the state and the government agencies. So it's been nicer.
So tell me what kind of stuff somebody can buy here.
What you can't buy is anything that goes up or blows up. That's kind of the easier way to tell you. For the most part, fountains, we call them safe and sane. Nothing that blows up, nothing that flies in the air and creates a report or a break. So fountains, generally they shoot up about 10, 15 feet, a crackle, spark, things that spin on the ground, sparklers, of course. The fireworks industry has gotten pretty creative with different products and different ways to display the products, yeah, for entertainment purposes.
So we are inside a tent, and it's the middle of the afternoon, and I got to tell you, it's kind of warm in here. I mean, yeah. Are people willing to come in and browse outside here, especially around July 4th?
Nothing stops them on July 4th, and New Year's, for that matter. Last New Year's, the day before New Year's was a great, beautiful day, and the day after, the New Year's Day, New Year's Eve day, was raining all day long, all night long, nonstop. It was raining. People still came out. Nothing stops them. They still want to have fun.
Doesn't matter if they're sweating, they want to get their fireworks.
Yeah, rain or heat, they just get their fireworks and move on.
Do you find that there's any amount of competition between your company and some of the other companies that have tents up around the valley?
There's always competition, of course, you know, different manufacturers, different products, different display, different advertising techniques. So, but competition is good. So it keeps everybody on their toes and keeps everybody up.
So can I ask what you do on the night of July 4th?
I work until midnight.
People buying fireworks right up until midnight?
About 11 o'clock it starts to slow down, yeah.
So you don't get to really see any fireworks yourself?
No, our family has celebrated 4th of July on the 5th, so we take what's left over and we blow it up on the 5th of July at my household.
Jason Hallaby runs Loco Fireworks. It has 3 tents this season in the Southeast Valley. Still to come, Phoenix voters will be deciding this summer whether to tax themselves to pay for transit projects, including expanding light rail.
That will be wonderful because it'll bring the prosperity that's associated with the light rail to our entire city.
The construction of light rails always go over budget, over schedule, and it's a centuries-old technology.
Pros and cons on Prop 104 are ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark. I'm Steve. Partly cloudy skies in the valley forecast for tonight. Monsoon storm is possible, and that would include lots of blowing dust. Currently, we have mostly clear skies and 104 degrees. In valley traffic, already some accidents for you to watch out for. 202 westbound the Santan Freeway, the right lane is blocked at Val Vista. 202 westbound the Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at McClintock, also a collision I-17 northbound at Anthem Way, blocking the left lane. It's 223.
KJZZ is supported by Local First Arizona, celebrating Independence Week now through July 5th by encouraging consumers to support the independent businesses that keep Arizona's economy diversified and strong. LocalFirstAZ.com.
Phoenix
Phoenix voters will decide this summer whether to extend the city's current 0.4% transit sales tax and increase it to 0.7% over 35 years. The extra money would pay for transportation projects, including roads, buses, and expanding light rail. We're going to hear from a supporter and opponent of Prop 104 today. We start with Phoenix Councilwoman Kate Gallego. She's the co-chair of Move Phoenix, the group formed in support of the measure.
It's an all-of-the-above transportation plan, so investments in roads, light rail, bicycle infrastructure, bus system.
Does Phoenix really need this?
We really do. We now replace our streets or do what's called an overlay once every 60 years. And people are telling us you need to invest in your streets. We have a pothole problem. So we really need that ability. We also need more funding for new streets. Right now, we have some very quickly growing areas, including around the airport, where we're seeing a lot of economic development. But often those projects need just small streets to be added before they can come in. And the lack of funding is holding up jobs. So we want to make sure we prioritize that. We want to grow the light rail system. This plan will allow us to triple it between now and 2050. And that will be wonderful because it'll bring the prosperity that's associated with the light rail to our entire city.
Critics of this proposal, as you know, have been talking about the cost of some of the transit, especially light rail and what it will cost to build a mile of light rail. Does that argument resonate with you at all?
This is a great opportunity for investment and economic development. That was my background before I ran for city council. And as an economic development professional, I've seen when we have corporate headquarters coming into the valley, they really are asking us, what locations do you have along light rail? They're much less interested in the other parts of our community. We just aren't seeing the same economic development. People in the real estate community like the permanent nature of light rail. A bus route can move, but light rail is permanent and it's faster. It can move more people. This really has put us on the map in terms of a destination for major events. So I think it really is a permanent economic development investment.
What do you make of the argument that this amount of money that this additional sales tax would raise would be better spent elsewhere?
We really need to invest in our infrastructure. It's what allows cities to grow and to prosper. And we hear over and over again from the business community, we want you to invest and we want a long-term commitment so that we know what to expect and we can respond accordingly. So this will allow us to take all of the money that currently goes from our general fund, which can be spent on anything for transportation, including the bus system. And we will no longer need to take money from the general fund. It will be transportation. Mass transit will support itself. So that will free up a lot of money for other expenses. This city council has said our first priority is public safety. So money that used to go to transit, this city council has said we'd like to spend on police and fire.
So if Prop 104 passes, the vision is that the general fund won't fund transportation at all anymore?
It will not fund any of the public transit system, so the bus system and rail system. There are some infrastructure expenses that are related to roads that will still come from the general fund.
When you're talking about sales tax, you're obviously at least in part dependent on consumer behavior and people buying stuff. So when you're looking at funding so many projects, how do you make sure that the money will be there based on consumer habits and what else the economy is doing?
We think this makes sense given the uses. So people who are visiting our community from elsewhere will pay sales tax. And there are huge users of the light rail system. We have a lot of people who come for conventions. They don't want to rent a car. They love being able to hop on the rail at the airport and take it downtown to those hotels and convention centers. So they'll be paying sales tax and helping contribute to our prosperity and our new infrastructure, which makes sense. It is a long-term plan, so we will have years to smooth it over, but we will watch quickly and closely to see if the economy is changing so that we can adjust.
Councilwoman Kate Gallego is also the co-chair of Move Phoenix, the organization supporting Prop 104. Kate, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
If approved, the tax would take effect on New Year's Day 2016. Matt Kenny, though, is working to defeat it. He's the chairman of No on Prop 104.
I don't support it for several reasons. One, I mean, I don't agree that the light rail in any way is right for the city. The construction of light rails always go over budget, over schedule, and it's a centuries-old technology. That's not a solution for a city that is not a centralized metropolis, but something that's growing out. We expand outward here in Phoenix. You can't have a static light rail as a solution to our transportation problems. And the price tag is too much, right? $160 million a mile, $31 billion tax increase over the next 30 years. At this price tag and the fact that it just doesn't make sense for Phoenix tells me that this is a common sense no on Prop 104.
What do you make of arguments from supporters that say, look at the existing light rail line and all the development that's come along it, and people really want to be near the line and it's exceeded its ridership projections? I mean, what do you make of arguments like that?
Well, a couple things. One, we've seen and we'll be doing a campaign to get small businesses to sign off. There were a lot of small businesses that were destroyed by the light rail and its construction. On top of that, during the construction, it will lower the appraisal prices of small businesses and the real estate that they own and allow big businesses to come in, purchase that at a value because they're not getting any customers because the light rail construction is preventing people from coming to their businesses. And then, yeah, they can take advantage of the benefits that the light rail will provide.
Do you think that the tax increase shouldn't happen at all, or do you just object to where the money that would be raised from that would go?
Both. I think that we need to focus on expanding our freeway systems, increasing their capacity. I understand that we need to build infrastructure, right? But for you to lump buses, highways, a light rail expansion all into one giant sales tax is misleading to the taxpayers.
I want to ask you about another one of the arguments that supporters have made, which is that if this is approved, it means that money in the general fund won't have to be used for street maintenance and other kind of infrastructure type projects because it'll have this separate source of money coming in, which frees up general fund money to pay for things like public safety and deal with the pension problem in the city and just sort of general operating budgets for the city. Does that resonate with you at all?
It doesn't. I don't know if you've seen it, but they have also limited the tax increase to $10,000, right? So that means that the middle class is burdened with this entire tax, and any purchase that is made over $10,000, this new tax does not apply to them, right? So basically what you're saying is to bail out the city of Phoenix, we are going to tax the middle class in order to allow them to use their general fund in a way that they should have. How about you just get a balanced budget? How about the mayor really sets up a way for Phoenix to be prosperous?
You're advocating that Prop 104 not pass, but you've obviously identified some types of infrastructure needs that the city has. What would be your solution to find the money to pay for more buses and dealing with roads and things like that?
Well, first, we need to balance the budget. The same way that the governor is balancing the budget for the state, our city council and our mayor need to take time to balance the budget here in the city. And then we need to find solutions for each one of those individual problems. But we can't just lump them all together and say, hey, we're going to raise taxes to the middle class, and this is going to bail us out of all the mistakes that we've already made.
Matt Kenny is chair of the No on Prop 104 campaign. Matt, thank you.
Oh, I appreciate it, Mark. Thank you for allowing me to come onto the show.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Miranda, and I work at Skateland in Chandler. As soon as you walk in, you see that big, huge rink, and you just want to be on it. Right now, we have our summer kids camp going on. We skate, we do different kinds of activities and crafts.
What do you guys want to play?
Freestyle!
Yeah!
Go, go, go!
They play arcade games as well as skate floor games. Maybe around 5 years old, I can remember roller skating. And it's just really fun because kids are like innocent. So hanging out with them is just kind of like you're going back to being a kid. And that's the great part about it.
Do you want to play?
Hanging out with them is like bringing you back to being young again.
That was Miranda Vasquez, a camp counselor for Kids Camp at Skateland in Chandler. If you've got suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
Still to come, do shoppers need an attitude adjustment in order to stop wasting food?
if we shopped more frequently or in closer proximity to when we actually are going to consume the food, we would be better at estimating more accurately what we need.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon in Valley traffic. Looks like some people have left work a bit early. We have several accidents to tell you about. 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, a collision at McClintock. Also the 202 westbound Santan Freeway at Val Vista, an accident blocks the right lane. Also State Route 347 northbound, there's an accident at Riggs. We're also seeing some moderate slowing on I-17 southbound approaching Thomas. Mostly clear skies and 104 degrees at 234.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, ranked the top cancer hospital in Arizona by U.S. News & World Report. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
Researchers at the University of Arizona wanted to find out why we throw away so much food at home. Anita Bapu is one of them. She's an associate professor of retail and consumer sciences. She and her students surveyed a group of consumers buying by looking at the daily details, what they buy, how often, what goes in the crock pot, and what ends up in the trash can. And they found shopping habits play a big role in waste and consumption. So, Anita, is this the classic case of our eyes are bigger than our stomachs or maybe our refrigerators, and we just end up buying more than we intended?
We didn't see as much evidence for what I would call unplanned purchases. So, you know, you walk into Costco, there are all those nice ladies at the carts giving you stuff to try. We didn't really see that much evidence of people buying sort of unplanned in that way. But they were buying aspirationally in terms of both what they wanted to feed their families and households and also what they had hoped to be using for an extended period of time. So most people were shopping on a week or a two-week basis.
What kind of food did you find was most likely to get thrown out?
So generally speaking, the data at large is, you know, related to sort of perishable or food that's grown. So we're talking about, you know, veggies, meats, even things like dairy. So the types of things that we would be buying, quote unquote, fresh. So that's where you see the most waste, as you can imagine, because there's both sensitivity to labeled expiration dates on a lot of those goods, as well as our sense of what a good versus a not so good vegetable or fruit look like. So we have some sense around that. So we have concerns about food safety, which is known to be one of the reported drivers of why people throw food out. But we also see a fair amount of food waste in the way that people cook food, but they don't necessarily eat it all, or they plan to cook it, but they don't end up cooking it. And then that product that they were going to cook expires or goes bad, you know, in quotes. So however they perceive that bad to be.
Do you find any connection between what you found in this report and people's going to sort of big box grocery stores? You don't go to sort of the neighborhood grocer anymore. You go to a place like Costco or even just a regular supermarket where you can get so much stuff.
It's not so much that we found evidence about where they were shopping, but more about how they were shopping. So the how part is that because we have this relatively long planning horizon that we're shopping for, a week or 2 weeks, and we're also shopping for multiple people, there's a lot of estimation being done, right? We're forecasting at one level or another. And in forecasting how much we might eat and what we might eat and when we might eat it, we tend to be aspirational and overbuy. So we're buying more than enough so we don't run out. And then you layer that with people's sensitivity to price and value. So they are doing calculations around, okay, well, if I buy those little cherry tomatoes in this large box at Costco versus buying a smaller amount, say at Safeway, I'm getting more per dollar at Costco than I am at Safeway. So, you know, my costs upfront are cheaper. But what's not factored into that calculation by the consumer is that we throw out quite a lot of what we buy, and therefore we don't end up getting a better deal.
So is the answer then to buy fewer things, less product, but do it more frequently?
That's what we are thinking. If we shopped more frequently or in closer proximity to when we actually are going to consume the food, we would be better at estimating more accurately what we need. So we're not shopping for a two-week horizon. And that's hard to do in our typical everyday American lives. And the good news is there are lots of smart people thinking about this problem, and there's some different, you know, technology-enabled solutions out there that we're looking at, and we will probably do some testing with to see whether they actually help consumers essentially buy food just in time. And to be frank, study after study will tell you that grocery shopping is not a pleasant experience, at least as in its current manifestation. So most consumers think of it as a chore. It's not actually something they like doing. And so if we can provide more value in a time-strapped society to consumers by, you know, bringing down the cost of these services to where it becomes not only good for consumers' pocketbook, but for the planet and for people at large in terms of the environmental impact of food waste, then I think we're on the right track.
Anita Bapu is an associate professor of retailing and consumer sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Anita, thank you.
Thank you so much.
A South American company that builds massive lagoons is looking to expand into Arizona and other Western states. It's already developed the huge bodies of water in places including Dubai, India, and Saudi Arabia. Mike Sonics wrote the story about this. He's a senior writer for the Phoenix Business Journal.
It's a company called Crystal Lagoons, and they're based out of Chile. That's where they got their start, and that's where their founder is from. They have a U.S. headquarters in Miami, and they basically build these liners that are manufactured in Texas. They're synthetic. It's about 6 to 8 feet deep, and they create these huge lagoons. I think the biggest one they have is 20 acres, and the thing that kind of sets them apart is the water looks like water you'd see like in Tahiti or the Caribbean. It's really crystal clear. So they're trying to enter the U.S. market more, and they've been out here in Arizona, looking at California, and then obviously Las Vegas.
Why Arizona? I mean, what's the benefit of having one of these things?
They say, you know, just it adds a lot of value to a project. It's a great amenity to have, whether it's a resort or a big housing master plan development. And they really add a lot to kind of arid climates. A lot of places that they've been, Chile on the Pacific coast of South America, Egypt, Jordan, kind of some more brown, arid locations where the water really stands out. People can swim in them. You can, you know, do other kind of limited water sports in them. And they're just, you know, very striking because of the scale of them and because of the color of the water.
So given the fact that we are in the midst of a historic drought in this part of the country, where does the water for these massive bodies of water come from?
They say they can use all kinds of water. They can capture rainwater. They can use all kinds of different water that's not drinkable. And so they say that they're kind of cost effective and conservation effective. I mean, they're in some places that are water challenged too. And so they say that they don't lose a lot of water. That some of the chemicals they use reduces the evaporation. The one question I had them is, well, can you make this into drinking water? Because you think of some of the parts of the world that they're in, it can't be made into drinking water. But they say they can, you know, capture a lot of water, use a lot of water, brine type water, stuff that we wouldn't be able to drink or use, and kind of treat that enough to give it kind of that blue Caribbean tinge, and it can be used, you know, for recreational purposes.
Do you have a sense of where in Arizona they might be looking? Are there specific developments or specific projects they're looking for here?
They said they have a couple projects in the works and they're meeting with more people, but they haven't really disclosed yet. You know, I could see something in Scottsdale, a new resort or a resort that's going through, you know, a revamp or modernization. Certainly casinos, you think about Vegas, but certainly down here with some of the money that the Native American communities are putting into their gaming facilities, you could see something around that. And then even though, you know, housing's been kind of slow to come back, especially kind of in the suburbs, we still have a few master plan communities out there. You could see somebody trying to do something there, maybe not on a 20-acre scale like you'd see at some huge resort somewhere, but just a nice amenity to draw people in.
Well, given the water situation around here, I mean, are developers still looking to do water feature type things like that? I mean, is it seen as maybe we shouldn't do that anymore if for no other reason than it just kind of looks bad?
I think there is a challenge with that. You know, I think you've seen this. The golf course folks have gone through that too, and so certainly with the drought and the situation here and in California, and Nevada, I think they will have a kind of a challenge in talking to developers and people doing projects about that. What does it look like to the public? You know, how much water are we going to have to have? And so I think there is some considerations there, both from kind of a bottom line business model, because we don't know what's going to happen with our water levels, you know, long term, and in terms of perception stuff. So yeah, I think you'll see some folks, you know, think about that.
Mike Sonnix is a senior writer for the Phoenix Business Journal. Mike, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. An ape is trying to climb on a pole that's 60 feet high. Due to the slippery surface, the ape climbs 3 feet in a minute, only to slip back 2 feet. How much time will it take the ape to reach the top? Hint, the answer is not 60 minutes. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw 2 names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark. He's Steve. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Very close to home in traffic on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at the Center Parkway has the right lane blocked. And on the 202 westbound Santan Freeway, an accident at Val Vista has the right lane blocked. Look for partly sunny skies with a high of 108 for the rest of the day today. It's 104 at KJZZ at 247.
KJZZ is supported by Community Tire Pros and Auto Repair, providing complete auto repair and tire care for domestic and import vehicles through the High Mile Club, a proud member of Local First Arizona. Info at communitytirepros.com.
It's been another challenging week in the realm of for-profit education. On Tuesday, the Valley-based Apollo Education Group announced its revenue had decreased by 14%. And over the past 9 months, Apollo's University of Phoenix had dropped nearly 900 employees. Derek Anderson is an assistant professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. So, Derek, what does this say about the for-profit education industry generally?
Well, one thing that we've seen in the case of the University of Phoenix is that they have this long history and they have this really rich DNA that goes back many decades, and they've changed a lot over time. But it seems to be the case that they've adopted a set of strategies that are really trying to improve outcomes for students. And from an education perspective, this is right on track. But then when you sort of view it from an investor's perspective, there seems to be some concern there.
So how troubling and how complicated can that get when we're talking about a company that's really trying to serve two very distinct masters?
I think it can be really challenging. And I think that one thing that we need in order for our, you know, in order for our social system here to work is for businesses to maximize profit. And when they don't do that, shareholders and investors have a right to be concerned. And on the flip side, we also need institutions like universities and colleges to put student outcomes as a priority. And so the challenge here is to design a company, and these are companies, but to design a company that is allowed to and expected to maximize profit, but to do so in a way that also does not threaten the interests of students. And that's a really challenging thing to do.
Do you think there are strides being made in that? Do you think that there are companies sort of realizing that's the direction to go?
I think that there are, and I could give you a few examples.
Please.
So one example that I've seen is the Flatiron School in Manhattan. And this is a school that's not a credential-driven school. It's an experience-driven school. And so they teach people how to do programming for mobile applications. And they created their own unique curriculum. And they have a really simple payment model that does not involve student loans. It doesn't involve student debt. And it really has strong incentives for students to be placed in partner employers that the Flatiron School has. And so so they think about, you know, student enrollment, student education, and then also student job placement in their entire business model.
The University of Phoenix, the Apollo Group, is one of the few companies that of the larger variety that's been headquartered in the Valley, in Arizona. We don't have that many of those. And I'm wondering if Apollo Group continues to struggle and maybe doesn't change on the fly in some of the ways that you're suggesting, can there be a negative economic impact on what goes on here? Does it carry a big enough stick in this area where we could see negative economic effects from that?
One thing I can say is that when we do look at the data and we look at, for example, student defaults, just the number of students that are in student loan default, we just compare the states, Arizona stands out as the state with the most student loan defaults, and it's because a lot of those defaults are from for-profit institutions that are in Arizona.
Do you consider this still to be a place that can be pioneering as it relates to for-profit schools? Obviously, I mentioned the Apollo Group. We have Grand Canyon University is remaining for-profit. Do you see them continuing to leave a big mark here?
Well, one thing I do see is that Arizona has a capacity to be a leader and an innovator in education generally. And so I think that includes public, private, and potentially also for-profit higher education. The challenge here is that because of the resource abundance, there really hasn't been much of a need for for-profit universities to really be innovative. And so where we have seen lots of innovation has been in our public institutions that have experienced resource constraints. And so a lot of times we think businesses are innovative, but really a major predictor of innovation is just resource constraints. And I think that's something to take into consideration here.
Derek Anderson is an assistant professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU.
A 20-story office building on the corner of Central and Washington in Phoenix recently sold for more than $93 million. The new owners say they'll invest more than $1.5 million to renovate 1 North Central. Chris Mackey is Phoenix's Community and Economic Development Director and says the sale is a good sign for downtown Phoenix and high-rises in general.
You know, our most recent high-rise vacancy rates we've seen are coming down significantly, especially here in the Midtown and downtown market. Midtown has dropped by about 15 percentage points since towards the end of last year, and downtown is down about 5 percentage points in its vacancy rates. So what we're really seeing is a strong return into the central city of companies that are interested in being near the amenities.
Are you seeing some buildings that are more attractive to renters or leasers than others, irrespective of where they're located?
There are definitely buildings that are much more attractive to renters than others. And what we're really seeing in those buildings that are more attractive is they've either been retrofitted, so they're older buildings, but the landlords have upgraded the lobby and brought the floors into the 21st century, or we are seeing the newer buildings, particularly those that have retail amenities on the ground floor. They've got coffee shops, they've got sandwich shops, kind of easy connected for their clientele.
How much does their location play into it, though?
Location is, you know, the three most important things in real estate, truly. When you look, it's the buildings that are doing incredibly well are those that are immediately adjacent to or within three blocks of light rail. For downtown, it would be those buildings that are kind of in between Washington and Fillmore, right off of light rail. And in Midtown, it really seems to be the epicenter is at Thomason Central.
So if you have a building that is not in one of those locations, does that mean that as an owner, you have to maybe do a little bit more to make it more appealing to people?
You know, I think it does. I think you do have to make it a little bit more appealing to others because the first place that people migrate to is where the activity is. Activity breeds activity.
Do you think the sale of 1 North Central tells us about anything that we should be looking for down the road?
You know, I think it does. I think what the sale of 1 North Central shows us is that investors have returned to the central city. It's not a market that is a secondary market any longer. It's a primary market as investors are looking at. And I think the central city is truly heating up. One of the reasons that we're seeing those building sales and seeing the return of those sales is we're seeing a significant return of tenant activity to the market. And that's really getting out into the national investor market is how much we're seeing tenants actually return to the downtown market, not as a secondary source because it's an inexpensive location, but because they know that's where their workforce is.
Chris Mackey is Community and Economic Development Director for the City of Phoenix. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
The past few nights have featured some pretty spectacular light shows in the valley with bolts of lightning crackling. Ron Holly is a meteorologist based in Tucson, where he works for the Finnish firm Vaisala. He says Arizona's lightning season generally only lasts about 2 months, but usually doesn't start this early.
It's definitely early. In the last 6 days of June here in Tucson metro area, I live in the north side, I heard thunder every day for the last 6 days of the month, which is, I've been here 15 years, we've never had anything like this before. So the season, the monsoon season, has started a week to 10 days early. It's very early.
Why is this happening?
The ridge of high pressure that normally is over Arizona toward the end of June is actually much further north, so it's very hot in the northwest, and that particular pattern gives easterly winds to southern and central Arizona, bringing up moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, from the mountains over Mexico, and actually some of it coming up at the low levels from the Gulf of California. So this is a typical pattern, but it's about a week to 10 days early, and it's also pretty strong.
Are we seeing lightning strikes that are hitting the ground, or is this mostly cloud-to-cloud lightning? What's happening?
Well, about 3/4 of lightning actually stays in the cloud. But the cloud-to-ground part is the one, of course, that does the damage and is dangerous. That ratio doesn't really change too much from year to year, but there's just a whole lot more lightning around on an earlier time scale this year than normal.
Is this indicative in any way of what we can or should expect from the monsoon for the rest of the season?
It's hard to tell what the whole season is going to be in general. The longer you can have the monsoon in place and producing moisture, have enough moisture to produce thunderstorms every afternoon, the better chances are that you'll have heavy rain at your house several times. So if this pattern persists, this could be an above average year, but it can change a week from now when we can go to the opposite side of the dry side with no problem at all. It can just do that.
Have we been seeing a lot of rain associated with the thunder and lightning that we've seen and heard?
In general, it hasn't been all that rainy. I think because it started so early, it isn't as deep moisture as it will be, as it typically is toward the end of July into early August.
Ron Holly is a meteorologist with the firm Vaisala. He's in Tucson. Ron, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Phoenix loves sci-fi.
That would be a great t-shirt.
It would. It's also the name of a film screening event that makes its debut tonight. It'll include short science fiction films produced in Phoenix over the last year.
And some of these films show that science fiction in turn loves Phoenix and Arizona for the diverse scenery.
One movie, Focus, is the story of a girl who finds a camera lens that allows her to see into the past of its previous owners.
There's a scene in the movie where the main character meets one of those owners in front of a picturesque mountain range dotted with saguaros.
What are you doing out here?
What?
It's the middle of nowhere.
Director Matt Chesson says the scene wasn't quite in the middle of nowhere.
The film was shot entirely in Arizona. There's a really beautiful mountain scene that's in the film that we shot at Bumblebee Ranch up north.
That's right off Interstate 17 if you're driving north from the valley. Chesson says what he loves about filming in the state is the unexpected places you discover as a filmmaker.
There's a lot of hidden locations in Arizona, and you just kind of have to research and explore our state, and then you can come across some really fantastic locations like areas in Tucson or Jerome, Flagstaff.
The films shown tonight include scenes in historic homes and even downtown Scottsdale, places we're familiar with, yet they're changed by the plots and time periods of the films.
Like the warehouse basement in Vault of Souls, The Pact, you'd never guess it was just a regular basement under Grand Avenue.
If I wanted to escape, I would just
face down. Now.
Cassandra Nicholson is with Filmstock Film Festival and the organizer of Phoenix Loves Sci-Fi. She says from urban sprawl to wide open landscapes, Arizona provides those settings for sci-fi filmmakers.
I mean, in terms of geography here, it's
pretty dynamic for one state. It is, I think, comparable to California's dynamism.
You can see what scenery you recognize at Phoenix Loves Sci-Fi tonight at ASU's Cronkite School of Journalism in downtown Phoenix at 7. Well, a lot of stuff going on for a Thursday. Actually, I exaggerate. There's really not that much going on. But if you're looking for a way to start your long weekend in sports, Diamondbacks hosting the Rockies tonight and the Phoenix Mercury hosting the Tulsa Shock. Both tonight, Mark, both within about a block of each other.
That's true. They are both within a block of each other. And they are both tonight. That is close. You can also check out the band 311. They're playing tonight at the Poolside Stage at Talking Stick Resort. That is not close to downtown Phoenix. It's along the Loop 101.
Not at all, but there is up on the woof. Doggy happy hour. That's tonight at 5 at the Luster Rooftop Garden in Phoenix.
Can't follow that up. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next, and be sure to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for another edition of the show.